We'll hear argument now in the fourth case of the morning, Hyman against Tate. Mr. Phillips.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court, I'm David Phillips on behalf of plaintiff Cheryl Hyman in this matter. And unfortunately, we have yet another code section to throw at you, but I've only got one. Section 1692K.
You're not going to ask me to read all decisions of the 18th and 19th century?
No, luckily this...
This statute wasn't enacted until much after
the 18th and 1970s. And, you know, I was reliving law school here this morning. I always hated the UCC and I always hated the bankruptcy code because it was a foreign language often provided without a competent interpreter. And...
Wait till you reach ERISA.
I looked at ERISA when I was a younger attorney. And
we'll be looking at ERISA in the next case.
I'm doing this instead. Simple issue here, I think. It's whether the bona fide error defense was proven by the defendant at trial.
Haven't you just said the magic word? There was a bench trial, there were findings by the district court, and normally we view things like negligence as finding questions for the trier of fact, and here the trier of fact has given us his view.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that I've got to overcome the clear error standard, and I think the record, there's clear error here as the factual finding, and I think there's clear...
Yeah.
I think there's an error as to his interpretation under the law and under this court's decision.
Mr. Phillips, help me with this.
Yes, ma'am.
Because it seems to me that your argument would require needless duplication of effort in that G&K would have to set up its own screening procedures to avail itself of the bona fide error defense, regardless of how effective the initial screening was by the creditor.
Not at all, Your Honor. That's one thing they could have done. They could have set that up, or they could have taken the minimal procedure that this court found would set up a bona fide error defense in the Turner versus JVD opinion that two of your colleagues were on, 2003 decision, where they said that, you know, you could take the minimal step of at least, you know, having an agreement with the creditor not to send you bad accounts. And that follows on with the Jenkins versus Heinz decision that this court came down with. It was one of the first cases on bona fide error where they had extensive procedures, and they had in writing, don't send us bankrupt accounts. And their sales force then followed up with the creditor client and said, make sure you don't send us, well, it wasn't bankrupt accounts, it was don't send us accounts with charges that weren't approved.
The district court found as a fact that not only was that implied in this kind of arrangement, but it seems to have been a big success. There were only 100 bankrupt accounts sent out of 1 million referrals, which is, one would think, pretty good for this kind of work.
Well, there are two issues there. Okay, let me take the first one. The bankruptcy court, or the district court here, was incorrect. The testimony, actually, was there was no procedure at all. None. There was no understanding.
That's not the question. I mean, the question isn't whether other procedures would have avoided the error. Seems to me the issue is whether the procedures that were used were reasonably adapted to avoid any error.
I think those issues are together, though, but there was no procedure here, Your Honor. If they would have said, you know, we've got to deal with you, don't send us bad accounts, creditor, that would be one thing, but that's not the case here.
Why do you require a formal contract if we know that what actually happens in the real world is a very successful filter?
Okay, well, we don't require a formal contract. It could have been oral. There could have been oral statement. Could have been oral discussion. There was none of that. And we're kind of leaping ahead to what I wanted to do second. What happens in the real world? We don't know.
We do know. The district court found that there were a million referrals, of whom only 100 were in bankruptcy.
No, what the district court found was a million referrals, and there was 100 complaints. Okay, all we know is how many people complained. We have no idea how many accounts were bankrupt.
You think some bankrupt accountants or debtors that went and paid?
I think. Well, the record
didn't call like this one did, and simply said, "Hey, this has been discharged in bankruptcy," and they immediately then dropped the case.
I think there are three possible logical responses if you got this and you're in this case. One is what my client did: called up and said, "Leave me alone. I'm in bankruptcy." Another thing, possibility, if people decide somehow this didn't get covered in my bankruptcy, I don't bother to talk to my bankruptcy attorney, I pay. Third one is I throw the letter out because I know I'm covered by bankruptcy, or maybe I just don't care about any communications like this. But we don't know about those other two-thirds. All their witness was able to testify to is to the one possibility, which is where they knew they had screwed up because someone had complained or they'd gotten some sort of notice elsewhere. But I really want to get back to, did they have any sort of agreement, written, oral, or otherwise? The transcript on this point is clear. There was no discussion about not sending over bankruptcy accounts. If we look at the transcript at record document 33, if we look at Mr. Smith's testimony, on page 26, beginning on page 26, he's asked, in your experience, do they regularly send over accounts in which there is a bankruptcy? No, they do not. Okay. Question, have you ever discussed whether that should occur or not? The court cuts in, and Judge Cannelli said, that is a yes or no question. Have you had discussions about whether they should, about whether they are going to or should or do send over bankrupt accounts? Answer, no. Have you discussed with them what the FDCPA requires in connection with bankruptcy accounts? Answer, no.
Well, the answer is, as the others pointed out, with the huge volume of accounts sent over, they had very few that were bankrupt. Now, I guess it would be a good thing to have said, don't send us bankrupt accounts or something like that, which is, I guess, like saying, don't send us accounts when they don't owe you money. If any client, anybody's a collection attorney, I suppose, and they get a bunch of names of people who don't owe the client money, then obviously there's going to be a problem.
Well, for the attorney, it's going to be a problem because if he's
not going to get any money.
Well, if he's actually acting as an attorney, well, not necessarily. If he's actually acting as an attorney,
it would violate some other part of the law.
It would. But if you're actually acting as an attorney, you know, and you're filing suits, you're going to be real unhappy because you're going to be filing suits that are going to be completely unsuccessful.
That's right.
If you're collecting, there's every incentive to collect on bankrupt accounts. There's a whole sub-industry out there of people that take packages of bankrupt accounts and sell them off to a scavenger who goes out and tries to harvest money on them by encouraging people to pay even though they don't owe.
Okay, is that what this law is supposed to protect the consumer against, one of those scavengers?
Oh, I think it does ultimately protect, because those kind of debts are covered by the Fair Debt Act, and if they do things that make it look like you still owe the debt. But I think here we're talking about a very minimal step. Reinforce with the creditor that it's serious to send you only good accounts that are current. As you question me, Your Honor, in the Turner versus JVDB account, you know, maybe it's a protection if you're told these are fairly current accounts, they've just gone delinquent, you really shouldn't have any radar up looking at this. This account was unbelievably delinquent. By the time this account was sent over to him, a bankruptcy had been filed, and not only was the original creditor noticed, there was another debt collector that had already been on the hunt.
What's this issue about an erroneous Social Security number? Is that an issue that they...
We don't know. That really didn't get developed very well at trial.
Okay.
But here's the third time. The court, and this is on page 20, have they ever told you, has anybody from Cross Country Bank ever said to you anything along the lines of, you know, we're going to be sure we don't send you accounts that are in bankruptcy, anything like that? Have they told you any procedures they go through to make sure they don't do that? Witness, no. They don't have any procedures. They had a hope. A hope is not a procedure. Otherwise, nobody, no debt collector would violate this act because they'd come in and testify, well, we hope we don't violate the act. That's our fond wish, our fond desire. In fact, the evidence in this case was directly contrary to any sort of agreement, written or oral. They had an explicit collection agreement with an integration clause. It was only one-sided. It's 8 pages, single space. They sure had room to put in whatever they wanted. Paragraph 5 says, Cross Country Bank says to its debt collector, if you find out they're bankrupt, we withdraw the account and send them back to us. And then paragraph 22 says, this is the entire agreement. There's no other deals here. So there was no procedure. There was a hope. And a hope is not a procedure. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Olson.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christine Olson, and I represent the Tate and Kerlin defendants. In this case, the district court found that Tate and Kerlin had procedures, reasonable procedures in place to prevent this type of error. And as counsel has stated, and as we have argued in our brief, I believe that is reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard, and I believe the evidence supports that conclusion.
Was it clear from the record that the statistic was true over a course of years as opposed to one particular year?
No, it seemed to be limited to a more discrete time period.
Okay.
Yeah. And here, regardless of the fact that this arrangement between Cross Country Bank and Tate and Kerlin was informal, it worked. There are going to be mistakes. That's why the bona fide error defense is there. The debt collector can't be perfect 100% of the time. And all that debt collector has to do is have steps reasonably in place. And what happened here is what works under the FDCPA. A mistake, unfortunately, was made, but the letter was sent out with a 1692G notification. The plaintiff called and said, I'm in bankruptcy, please stop collecting, and all collection activity ceased within the space of about a minute. And that's the way it's supposed to work, and that's the way it worked here. I don't believe, and I don't think the law in this circuit, especially under the Jenkins case, supports any requirement that the debt collector either go out and independently verify or investigate the status of every debt that's taken. I mean, with the volume of these accounts, the debt collectors would be out of business, as Mr. Smith said. And it is perfectly reasonable for a debt collector to rely on its client, and in this case, Cross Country has paid Kerlin's largest client, to only send over accounts that can be collected on. And as Mr. Smith testified, in the context of the debt collection business in general, it's foolish for these clients to send over accounts in bankruptcy. They know they can't collect. As he said, it slows the business down. Nobody's going to get any money out of it, and it's just not going to help any of the parties involved. No system is perfect. Nothing's going to work 100% of the time, but I think as the district court found here, in light of the magnitude of the accounts that were sent over and the small amount of violations that occurred, which came to about 8 per month, the steps, however informal, were in place to support the bona fide error defense. I have nothing further unless the court has questions.
Okay, thank you,
counsel.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Phillips? Wasn't much to respond to.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's in our brief and in our...
Good. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.